fired up.
And I just want to know, even before Kevin does the intro, how did you end up going to punk shows at 15 at Whiskey A Go Go?
Well, I have a big brother, an older brother. So that's the answer, tagging along with my older brother.
That's always the answer.
And we had good friends that he went to high school with that started the band, the Germs.
Oh my gosh.
So Paul went to high school with them. So.
Oh, the Germs. Yeah. See, Kevin's going to get so mad at me because I'm just like jumping into it. I should
You're jumping the gun, dude. Jumping the gun. Hey, where are you guys?
So I'm actually in New York this week because I had an emergency trip to see, I own a company that does like branded materials for large companies, and we had a little vendor issue because we try to get as much stuff made in the US as we can. So I needed to come out here and get something straightened up, which is nice because I get to stay on the Lower East Side for a few days and see family because my mom's family is from back here. So I'm going to go visit some people tonight. Cool. And Joshua,
where are you, Pepper?
Where are you, Joshua?
Oakland, California. Oakland, okay. California.
So how come 8 a.m. was the right time of day? No, I'm just kidding. I'm always up, but.
Because we have jobs.
Yeah. I have a job, so it's fine. I just, the impression I got was that you guys were in Europe or something.
No, this is the first time we've ever done a show this early.
Yeah.
This is
it's 11 for me right now, so I'm good with this.
Yeah, you're fine. I'm fine too. I just wondered because I like to know where people are anyway. Okay, we're ready to go.
Yep. We're all early birds here on the Adulting Well podcast.
Yes. That's right. We adult.
So I'll just start. Welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. My name is Kevin and I am your co-host, and I am joined as always by my co-host
Pepper. Hi.
And today on the show we are welcoming, you know, I mean really she needs no introduction in the punk scene, but legendary bass player and just fantastic musician Kira, and we are so excited to have you. I'm so glad that your team reached out to us.
Dialogue editor on Mad Max, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been a dialogue editor many years now. Thanks for having me, you guys. I'm excited to be here. I love the title, Adulting Well, because after all, that's what we never wanted to do, right?
Yes. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, I know people are going to want to hear about your history and but there's been a lot of interviews about that. I actually listened to the track that your team sent me, and I want to talk a little bit about this new record because, I mean, it's definitely something new as far as sound for you. I would assume because you're playing it so fluidly and flawlessly on the track that I heard that you've been working on this for a while, and it's probably a sound you've developed. But I mean, it's really interesting stuff. And it sounds like you're doing some multi-instrumental stuff on this recording as well. So let's start with the current stuff and then we can, you know, we can do some history and get, you know, fanboy giddy about some of your previous work that we're all very aware of. But let's hear a little bit about how this new record developed.
So in terms of the sound of the record, I've actually been working on two bass music and very sparse music for a long time, working with Mike Watt and Dose, which is a band we've been doing for many years. So the sparseness and the two bass, you know, a lot of the songs are two bass driven is not anything new. And I sang some in Dose too.
I've never heard of that.
Well, maybe you should have done some research because Dose has been around for 35 years and it's two bass players going the hell at it. But this record, I am not responsible for the multi-instrumentation. There are some amazing contributors on the record. The general way I operate, and actually I've been doing this for many years, is that I work in my room and write songs and express myself and try to get to the ugly inner emotions that need to be expressed. And then, and I usually lay down a bass or two and my voice. And then I actually have been doing sort of a virtual band type setup for a long time, where I send songs to this amazing guitar player, Glenn Brown in Ohio, who does some really delicate work on this record, a drummer who somehow manages to be super delicate, Dave Bach. I can't even imagine how he does this, because the music is so delicate, but he drums without, you know, bum rushing the whole show. And then of course my brother Paul, who always adds little tasty elements as well and helps me bring songs to fruition. So this process of doing songs like this has been going on for quite some time. There's still a list of 20 songs I've got in the works. This has just always been happening. But he asked me, being that he's involved in Kitten Robot Records, he asked me, he said they wanted to put out a solo record. And I had never really planned to put out a record, but I'm 60 this year. And it just was like, hey, yeah, maybe this is a good year to put out my first solo record.
Awesome. Well, and that's interesting that you've been doing this so long, and this is the first time you're doing a solo record. Your catalog is vast. You're on a lot of recordings, and I will say too, along with you and you have a very unique and honed style on the bass. Mike Watt is by far one of my favorite bass players. I've had the great fortune of meeting him briefly outside of a few shows when he was playing in Firehose. And he's just a hell of a nice guy too. So, you know, I mean, I think the combination of those things, like having that kind of like what feels to me like that, you know, that punk community ethic along with it is always nice with artists, because, you know, it kind of breaks down the barrier between the stage and the audience. And, you know, he's always been very approachable, and just judging by the first few minutes of this interview, I'm guessing that you're very much that way too. So how long did it take you to?
Extremely antisocial. But I do okay one-on-one, like this, but a group settings have never been that comfortable for me, but hey.
Interesting.
That seems pretty common with people that kind of go into their workshop and make stuff and then come out and show it to people and then go back in their workshop.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, so how long?
Okay. You were going to ask a question.
You developed this record, and you have, obviously it's been an interesting time. You know, let's maybe talk a little bit about if there has been any difference in your process, given the fact that you can't be in person with people and many people, and if it's allowed you to kind of expand your horizons in terms of who you're working with.
Actually, this record tells a story, and it's chronological. And the first song was done 13 years ago. So the pandemic really didn't change my process much. I have been doing this virtual thing for many, many years. The main reason probably, I mean, it started out this way is, you know, I work a straight job. I adult well, yeah. Actually. Yeah. So the time that I'm productive, if you will, in music is often like 6:30 in the morning. Well, no one wants to play with me then. So That's when I do my work. And then by sending it to other people, they can work at their convenience and they can do their adulting, you know? So the pandemic really didn't affect the process or the instrumentation or anything. I actually took on a project during the lockdown when things were really quiet, producing a record and for Glenn Brown, this guitarist, which we put out on Bandcamp just recently. And I just took that on to learn to mix and master. It's a set of rock songs that I had played the bass on, and I just needed a project. So that's something I just took on to amuse myself. But again, this process of developing the songs like the are on this solo record has just been the way I do things, and it's been going on forever, and it will go on for many more years, whether any more records come out.
So when you say chronological, it kind of makes me think that, you know, back in the 50s, there was kind of a singles attitude when it came to music. And then we kind of got into this album era. And when you talk about a chronological thing, it makes me want to think of it as one complete piece and not something that you would listen to out of order or in singles. And I really like the idea of an album, you know, yeah, with a whole journey. The last song is the end of the journey. That's very impressive.
Yeah. I mean, the last song we were finishing up this year, and it's definitely expressing much more current feelings about what the story is about. And yeah, I mean, it's not even so much that the story hangs together like an opera. It's just a bunch of snippets in time, many of which relate to the same subject. But of course, over time, things change. So it's a story of love and loss, and it starts more in the, you know, love arena and goes through this very painful loss and the aftermath thereof. So yeah, it felt like it hung together as a set of songs.
Well, and that's also incredibly
relatable. You find that, so you must have changed a lot. Yeah, and you must have changed a lot over that time. So I'm guessing that when you look at the beginning of the album, you're going, whoa, I don't know if I can even relate to that person exactly, right?
Well, I certainly can't sing the way I sang. You know, your voice changed.
Right.
Look, age is part of the process, right? So there's physical changes that occur even more than maybe emotional. You know, at my age, it may not be as much the emotional things that have changed in the last 13 years, but physically I've changed and circumstantially, you know, so I've changed. So I like the idea of tying together a set of moments, and each one of them I can go to that place and that emotion and that moment in time, if you will.
Yeah. Well, so talk about that a little bit. Like, what, how does it feel to sort of have the project complete and now being released after all these years of working on it?
Well, like I said, I never intended to release it. It's actually officially releasing October 19th. So it's been this, I don't know, it's strange because since I never intended to release it, it's been interesting going through the process of trying to, you know, generate some interest in this very weird music. You know, I remember sitting down with the record label and saying, so you guys know this is really weird music and it's not going to sell a lot of records, right? Like, you know, this, let's just be clear, you know, because I mean, anyway, they were kind enough to do it. And
what does promotion look like? Like, I haven't been in bands since we put flyers on walls and all this stuff. So I don't know, like, what even promotion looks like.
So I've been doing a lot of press. I've been doing a lot of interviews. I did photo shoots, if you can imagine. You know, I did that kind of stuff. But it's mostly been, you know, doing press, and there's publicists involved, and you know, never had such a thing really. I mean, although I think there was a publicist involved with Dose for a little while, but I always had a band, you know, a compadre, another, you know, other people doing some of the stuff, the designing of the video or the you know, album cover or whatever. This is just all had to be me. So, you know, constant sort of questions and decisions and trying to be visually creative when I have no such talent. I am an audio person. You
know? For what, the album art and stuff like that?
And the video that's out.
The video?
The Ghosts. Oh, you got to check it out. This director did a beautiful job. And the song you heard is The Ghosts, probably is the video. And of course, what happens is it's just like a song. You get an idea or an emotion or a sort of sense of what you're trying to do, a concept, and then it takes on a life of its own, and the end result is nothing like what you planned, but it's somehow beautiful, you know. So yeah, check out the video.
I think Tom Waits, I heard him describe it as your idea is like if you have your hands full of water and you're trying to carry that water over to a bucket and like you try to hold as much as you can without losing it before it gets.
But it's raining. So there are, you know, there is, you know, stuff coming in. It's crazy.
It's amazing. So you worked with Mike Watt on, well, I mean, you two were married at one point, but you worked with Mike Watt on Dose for many, many years. What was it like to work with another bass player? I mean, how did it like improve your playing, improve his playing? Like, I mean, you both have pretty unique styles and also bring a whole set of skills to the table that, you know, that are pretty, you know, like.
I'm so sorry. You're cutting in and out a bit, dude.
Kevin.
Hold on. Joshua, go ahead and ask another question. I'm going to see.
Kevin, can you stop your video?
Okay, I'm sorry. Your question was not coming across.
You're going to have to start over, buddy.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, great. What was it like working with Mike Watt for all those years? I mean, you two were married for a time and for a long time, and you worked on Dose for, what'd you say, 35 years?
Yes.
I mean, working with another bass player, how was that? You know, obviously, and you're both very unique musicians with incredibly, you know, amazing style and playing ability that you've honed over the years. How was it playing with a bass player versus like guitar and drums?
We did this project called Minute Flag way back in the days when he was in the Minutemen and I was in Black Flag. And that was sort of the first time that he and I jammed in the same room. And one of the things we discovered was that there was very little room for the two of us, much less room for anybody else. So when we first started playing together, it was right after D. Boone died. And I was actually afraid that Mike might quit the bass. So my goal was really to just get him to play. And I had actually been doing some two bass music on these bedtime story tapes where I would read a bedtime story for my nephews and then record intertwining basses. And some of those became part of the early Dose jams and even are on the first record. So there was a little bit of a precedent, but when we talked about having a band, it was just clear that there couldn't be anything else there. Neither one of us feel like the bass is limiting or a side or supporting instrument necessarily. We knew they could be lead instruments and we just needed the space to make it that way. So what it was like though was, it became very much an issue of the songwriting itself, because the leaving the spaces, finding the spaces with the second bass line, this construction of the song becomes everything in a band like Dose. We don't want either one to be subjugated by the other. So it has to be this process of carving out and creating spaces for each other.
Did you do that together or did you do that kind of separately and then come together?
Usually the songwriter and we each started with songs, you know, would write the first bass line. A lot of my songs, I would write the second bass line as well. And a lot of his songs, I would write the second bass line with his input. You know, usually at a certain point, once we brought it together, there were adjustments made. But so it really depended on how the song started. We also did a couple of cover versions of songs, Billie Holiday, Patsy Cline, Bessie Smith, and he helped interpret those. That was never a skill I had very well, so he was pretty instrumental in coming up with a way of interpreting those songs.
Oh, that's interesting. It would be interesting to hear a cover album in that style, actually. That's neat.
Completely. Yeah. So I wanted to jump in on one other more current topic pre the longer history, just around your sound editing career, because I mean, you've won a Grammy, an Emmy, I'm sorry. And you've also been doing this a very long time. And what drew you to that and got you into that world? I know people sort of in the entertainment world as well, that aren't musicians, and it's such a, you know, it can be a really tough go. you know, it's a high pressure industry.
Yes. Well, so I was in the computer field out of college. I had studied computers in school, and I was a computer programmer for the first 11 years.
What language did you program in?
Some fourth generation languages like Focus. Uh-huh. But I was not a particularly accomplished programmer. I moved into database design, was really more my cup of tea. But anyway, and I was quite good at quality control and testing software. So I specialized kind of in that arena.
Now we're talking my language.
But anyway, so I was doing that and kind of miserable in the corporate world, because you can imagine what it was like for me in the corporate world, trying to fit into that very stiff environment, being somewhat of a square peg in a round hole. And I and my brother was actually composing music for a student film, which this guy, Brian Franklin, was doing the sound for. He went to USC Film School, and they had me come in and play some bass. And I talked to the guy a bit about what he was doing, this, you know, sort of sound for film. And it seemed like such a perfect thing. It combined computers and audio. You know, it seemed like a really good fit. So I basically twisted his arm to hire me to his very tiny company. And, I said, I'll work for $8 an hour and answer your phones and run errands. And I'll learn a skill and find a way to contribute. And so that's kind of what happened. And then also, guys tend to like sound effects. They like explosions and guns and cars. And so there was a little bit of a niche in the dialogue side, and that made sense to me. Actually, in the industry at large, I'd say it skews a little female in the dialogue industry and part of the industry, and the sound effects skews more male. I have two Emmys, actually. And I was part of a couple of teams that got some attention from the Academy, team that won the Academy Award for sound editing, Mad Max Fury Road. And I was nominated with the team on Joker recently.
That was
those are movies that you can really distinguish the dialogue in.
Yes. Because
some movies I've found lately, it is really hard to hear the dialogue. And I feel like the explosions kind of take over everything.
Well, you know, to be fair, as you can imagine, the people in charge aren't necessarily the sound editors, you know, so they're not, none of us are responsible for whether or not you're going to actually hear it. The director will make decisions about how loud the music will be or the sound effects will be. So sometimes, that's a taste thing. Also, if you watch movies not in the theater, you're kind of, they're designed to play in the theater, right? You've got a center speaker for the dialogue and you have the music and sound effects split off. So when you try to listen to them in a different environment, it can sound a little bit more muddled than actually it sounded like when we mixed the movie.
Oh, so that's the same problem like when you record an album and you're in the studio and it sounds great, and then your friend listens to it on in their car and it sounds terrible.
Yeah, bass is very much affected by the engine of the car.
Interesting. I mean, I just think it's so amazing when, you know, people that have such an, I mean, you were a part of a very seminal, you know, moment in time for the punk scene, especially in Los Angeles. And you have this, like, also this amazing career. I mean, and have received accolades from your peers for what you're doing is in your career now as well. I mean, also, I want to just point out, you know, one of the more interesting things to me and hopefully to our listeners is the fact that you were a woman in that very male dominated punk scene in Los Angeles at that time. And you're a woman working in an industry, and maybe the specific part of the industry you're in has a lot of women in it, but it's a very male dominated industry as well in most ways. And, you know, you've sort of been, you've been kind of a pioneer in these areas. And I think there's other women in the punk scene from early on that have gotten, because they were lead singers or, you know, I've gotten a lot of the credit, but you were touring with a group of men you know, very at a very young age, you know, playing bass for a band that was even then very well known and, you know, selling out shows in all over the country and, you know, has become really one of the most legendary hardcore bands in the history of the genre. I mean, you know, without a doubt. I mean, how many hundreds and hundreds of people have I seen at shows over the years with Black Flag bars tattooed on them, you know? And so I just want to, you know, I want to take a pause here and just like, also thank you for being a pioneer for women in the punk scene, you know, and maybe talk a little bit about what it was like to be in a van full of dudes, you know, as a young woman, you know, not to jump subjects sure. too much, but it is an interesting part of your history.
So the truth is that the early punk days in Hollywood, you know, women were very well represented. And I was actually always fascinated that there were women that weren't even in bands that were quite kind of famous. They were on the covers of, you know, the fanzines and stuff because they were defining this look, right? They were the ones, you know, who looked all, you know, the makeup and the hair. And I mean, they were defining something that hadn't come before. I mean, I was a tomboy. I didn't know how to do makeup, and hanging around with the guys made sense. I had been tagging along behind my brother Paul my whole life, you know, just sort of following him wherever he went. So the playing in bands with boys made total sense to me. I like playing football with boys as a kid too, but. I mean, I think I once, I know, I only once tried to have an all-girl band and it didn't really work for me. And it felt a little bit like girls were different in the sense of how they approached being in bands. Guys have a tendency to treat it sort of somewhat professionally. You know, you go, you practice, it's just what you do. And there isn't a lot of, you know, complaining or, you know, I don't feel well or whatever. So it came kind of naturally to play in bands with boys. I didn't think much about it. And Black Flag was my favorite band when I joined them. So that also, and I did know, I knew them. I knew their approach. I knew how hard they toured and everything. So I was not surprised by what I was getting myself into. But you should know that at that time, it was still a very small scene in the sense that people didn't know who Black Flag was in the world at large. You know, the times have changed so much in that way that people might have actually heard of it. The truth is that it was all very underground, and even the big bands, quote unquote, were starving and were you know, touring in vans and sleeping on people's floors and not making a lot of money. So it's a strange time now that we look back and it's like Black Flag is this big thing, you know, influential perhaps, you know, and a lot of the bands, I think a lot of the reason that punk rock became known is because of bands like Nirvana and the Chili Peppers, and they would talk about their influences being like the punk scene and these early bands, and they pointed in a direction that people started looking at, because I never expected anybody to care personally.
Yeah. So there's a trend on this show, and I feel like we're repeating it here, which is that you are very DIY in how you learned how to do almost everything you do, right? Like you didn't go to school to be an audio mixer, for instance.
No, I studied computers in school. I had a bass teacher when I was 15 and 16, who was a jazz teacher, actually. But yeah, it's somewhat true that
well, you were saying earlier, like with the audio mixing, you just like barged in and were like, hey, teach me how to do this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it felt like the right kind of work for me, but I didn't really know about that. I mean, music I studied since I was six on piano, so So music just felt like, you know, sort of a part of me. Work-wise, it's a little different. You have to learn a skill, and truth is, most of us don't learn our skills at school. You know, school's more of an endurance test, and then, you know, you go out in the real world and you have to learn real stuff about whether it's business or programming or whatever. You know, I don't learn much of any of that in school. Probably the most important class I took was a basic accounting class, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think it's true that punk rock was a very DIY kind of thing, and nobody was showing us what to do or how to do it. And it has been sort of my approach to see openings and jump through them, whether or not I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think like I've learned my trade. I'm out here, you know, dealing with a mass order by just doing it. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to punk rock, for what I know. I mean, I feel like I learned everything I needed to know about my job, booking shows, putting on shows, playing in bands, touring, you know, dealing with merchandise, dealing with record labels, et cetera. And, you know, it's so interesting that I can extrapolate all of that into like a merchandise business now that, you know, over the years, we've grown into one with a global reach, which is incredible, but it's also, you know, it's kind of crazy to take it back to that as my point of learning. And, you know, I think one of the things that it instilled in me, and it sounds like in many ways it did in you too, was this like kind of tenacity and like, yeah, I can learn that. we'll just do it ourselves, you know, and if I can't do it, my buddy over here can do it, you know. And, you know, I just think it's such a, you know, it's one of the things we try to talk about on the show a lot, because it really is. It's like, it's such a unique part of this culture that people.
I think we all have this a different path, right? Yeah. I mean, my parents weren't here when I was 15. My mom moved away. She didn't abandon me. She wanted me to go too. I didn't want to. I stayed with my brother who was old enough, and I promised to finish school and be a good girl. So for me, some of it, the self-motivation was just to finish a commitment that I made and make sure I didn't get, you know, dragged off to Nowhereville, Florida, because that's not what I wanted. I was in LA and I wanted to play music. But so I think some of it is just our upbringing and how we learn to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. Some people have parents who are a little more involved in investing, and maybe they go a little slower, but the end result is generally at some point you have to start figuring your life out, right?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, it's, you know, I still begrudge having to work a 9-to-5, but you know, it's also built an incredible life for me, no doubt about it. Like I kind of have the freedom to do what I want, and you know, I think a lot of people, you know, especially here in this culture, we take that for granted. But I'm really interested to see too. Do you have, you know, talking about touring and bringing it back to the more present day, are you going to play any live shows with this record, or is it just going to be this project that gets out for everybody to hear?
I'm definitely not going on tour.
Yeah. totally understand.
Look, I don't know. I would love to find a way to perform and play. I mean, I loved playing live, but I haven't figured out exactly what that's going to look like yet. And, you know, when you're adulting, you have a lot of different responsibilities pulling on you, and you just have to do the best you can in terms of figuring out solutions to life's problems, you know. And so yeah, I want to find a way to do something live, but I also have some obstacles in the way, so I'm gonna figure that out, and I'll keep you posted.
Excellent. I mean, yeah, and do keep us posted. What are there any projects that you can talk about in your editing life right now? Or is there anything coming out soon that's wrapped that you can mention so we can give you a plug on those as well?
I have not been doing any real big movies lately. I actually, one of the ones lately that's been streaming is Cinderella, the new Cinderella. I worked on that, but I haven't worked on any really juicy projects. I worked on Those Who Wish Me Dead, which was cool. An Angelina Jolie project. And I seem to be on a little bit of a vampire movie trend. So look, you know, the funny thing about this career that I've learned is I can do great work regardless of the content. You know, I have somewhat of a separation. In other words, a movie doesn't have to do well for me to do good work and for me to be successful. So I just concentrate on doing good technical work, and I'm not that invested necessarily in the success of the project. It's nice when there's recognition and success, but that's actually few and far between. You know, there's a lot of projects and not a lot of them get, you know, big time attention.
Yeah, that makes sense. I you know, I think that's the interesting thing about artists too, is that, you know, having that pride in your work, regardless of whether it's successful or not, is, you know, it's a huge component of sort of what I've noticed is the artist brain. I mean, you know, I've got plenty of friends that do visual art that don't necessarily get gallery shows, but they absolutely love what they're doing. And when they complete a project, they're just so pleased, not so much that they're like, oh, I love my own work, but it's just like, it's very satisfying, you know, to have this like completed project done.
Yeah. You very much have to find joy in your creations, whatever the net result was. I mean, part of why I always separated music from my, you know, how I earned a living was so that I could make the music that I wanted to make. And I wasn't trying to rely on that as a mode of supporting myself. It means that there's less time for it, of course, but it also means I get to do whatever I want.
That's like my favorite philosophy. I do what I want.
Yeah.
Really. So, you know, again, I don't feel like we need to cover stuff that's been covered in a ton of other interviews, but I do have one question about the Black Flag experience, because I am just an amazingly huge fan of Bill Stevenson. I'm a drummer. And I just find his, you know, not only is his drumming just, I mean, it's otherworldly, but I mean, is he as interesting a guy as he comes across in like the films and interviews with him? I mean, he seems like such a complex character, but also like when you watch him play live, he clearly loves being behind that drum kit.
Yeah, I mean, Bill's amazing. I would not have survived my time in Black Flag without his power, which helped hold me up physically, you know, in terms of the difficulty of getting from 0 to 60 in terms of the physical style of play. But also just personally, he was someone who kind of was willing to share with me as we were figuring out the sort of emotional challenges of giving that much energy and time into something, you know, and so he helped me, you know, understand and explain things to me, and he just had a very focused approach, but it was a very personable teamwork. You know, it's weird. Bands are like marriages of multiple people, right? So you have to kind of all be on the same wavelength to make it work for a while. And he was very much a part of how I got on the right wavelength and could understand what was expected and what was needed and how to get there. So he was pivotal in everything in the early days of me, you know, just getting wound up to, you know, form.
You mean to have to be energetically like Black Flag?
Physically, you know, I mean, that just a bass is a physical instrument, and so is drums. And so in that way, we had that challenge to meet together, and he was the the teammate in creating a rhythm section that could be that powerful. Like, I don't think that, I mean, I'll give you an example. Okay. So Black Flag practiced about 5 hours a day. About 2 hours in, Henry would no longer be able to go. Now, 5 hours later, me and Bill would drop, and Greg could just jam with some other people and go for 10 hours, you know? So guitar isn't as physical, and he couldn't necessarily identify with the same struggles that we had, and nor could Henry, who you know, you can't really build up your voice, you know, but for us, there's this physical just building up to it and holding it up like a foundation, and that created this, you know, camaraderie that that was just, like I said, so important to getting going in that, and also personality wise, I think we had a little more in common and had a little softer side than Henry's very much a loner and wasn't, I mean, there was never fighting or unpleasantness, but we, you know, he would keep to himself, and Greg was a little bit more to himself, and Bill and I were a little bit more compadres in the adventure.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that I, you know, again, as a drummer, like, I just appreciate all of what you just said. I, you know, I find my relationships with the bass players that I've played with to be, you know, like, one of them that I haven't played with in almost 25 years is still one of my very best friends, you know, and he comes to my house for my birthday and we hang out. And it's just like, when you build those kinds of relationships, it is like a family. I mean, it really is. And, you know, I never toured really even close to that level, but a lot of the guys that I played with, especially bass players, I'm still super tight with. And it's just an amazing relationship, you know, that we get to have with people in this artistry. And, you know, I it's just nice to hear, basically. It kind of, like, that's our, I get that a lot of times during the show. I get that warm your heart moment. And I'm just like, you know, it's just like, that, just like, let's just tear down all the bullshit and just, like, talk about the relationships we get to have. And 'cause that's what any art is, really, to me, is how you're relating to your community, how you're relating to yourself, what you're putting out there as far as, like, you know, your perspective on whatever's going on. And that may come out as sound, it may come out as lyrics, it may come out as visual arts, it may come out as, you know, slight nuances in editing, you know, but it's all, you know, really comes back to that community and that relationship. And, you know, it's just, like I said, it's just nice to hear. I get a little, like, I get that, well, warm fuzzy.
It's chemistry in like a sports team or a band, right? There's this chemistry that happens between the members, however many there are, and sometimes that chemistry breaks down, and that's why bands can't survive it. But other times, as you say, it becomes something somewhat unexplainable. It just works.
Yeah. Well, so, what's your plan as far as, like, any other new music? Are you still, I would assume you're writing, by the way that you're talking, that you're just constantly working on stuff in your home studio and just in your room and kind of making things happen. But are you going to work on anything new? That's, 'cause it sounds like this current record is pretty much a theme, and it runs over a period of time. Is there any new concepts floating around in your head right now?
And there's always a set of songs as to whether they, you know, they don't necessarily, it's funny, you can't hang things together until they start to make sense. It takes somewhat after the fact to do that. You know, I have music in the works always. I have a project I do with another bass player, Devin Hoff, called Awkward, that we have an EP up on Bandcamp, and we're trying to do more of that work, but he's remote and busy, and so it doesn't always happen in the timely fashion, but he and I definitely have plans to do more, And, you know, like I said, the music will be happening. I just don't know, you know, in terms of what will be shared with the world. That's just not, it can't necessarily be planned the same way that, you know, songwriting can just be, you know, pushed along. That kind of stuff, openings happen and you jump through them. And so I don't know what's going to happen that way.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, we're running up on our normal time right now. So I just want to also honor people's schedules. Usually we try to get about 45 minutes in. We build that buffer in case there's some closing comments. Joshua, did you have any other questions for Kira before we go?
Just that it has been a real pleasure to talk to you. And I think you kind of embody everything we're kind of looking for, which is just someone that is exploring life and figuring out as they go. And every step along the way, at every age, it's a new thing, right? It's a new challenge. And I really love the way you kind of just jumped into things. And I really appreciate you both of you talking about the relationship between the bass player and the drummer, because as like the guitar singer in bands, I am kind of separate. I was kind of separate from that and doing my own thing a lot. And I didn't really think about that, but that's very touching.
It is. But I mean, I will say I've been kind of trying to keep myself in check throughout this interview. Like Black Flag was one of those bands when I spent a couple of years in high school in the late 80s in outside of Detroit. And I got there right after that last Greystone show, and all my punk friends there were raving about Black Flag at the Greystone. And, you know, I kind of missed that opportunity, but they were a huge influence on me early on as a member in bands, and just like, yeah, a bunch of kids from, you know, suburbia can get together and write songs and people will, you know, will listen and come see them play. And, you know, it's hugely impactful. And I don't think that can't underestimate what that kind of those years of the punk scene did for a lot of us. Cause I came in right behind you and just, it really is like so amazing to have you on the show. And, you know, I know a lot of people like to, you know, sort of like throw dirt on others. And it's just been nice to not hear any of that. Just like the good memories along with the great stuff you're doing now. It's just like, that's really, like Joshua said, what this show's all about is, you know, relationships and doing it as it comes. However life shows up is how we're going to deal with it. And it's just, I just really appreciate it, you know, and I know band dynamics can also get funky. So it's just nice to hear, like, nothing bad to say. This is just the experience that we had, you know. It's amazing. So yeah, I mean, just want to thank you.
We all are facing challenges all the time. So it's pretty important to try to connect in any way you can. And those connections, whether it's with people or in my music, you know, it's this idea of just trying to express those feelings and maybe people will connect to them. And in that way, we're just a little more connected than we were before, you know, and as you do, you know, get on in years, I think that becomes more important, the connections and the feelings and sharing the feelings. And during punk rock, it was hugely important that the anger and the rage that was expressed was something that we needed at that time. And now I'm exploring, you know, love and pain and things like that. I mean, I think that's what ties it all together. It still feels very punk rock to me. I'm not trying to be like anybody else. I'm completely nonconformist. And that's just the goal.
That is the bottom line, right? I mean, that's as punk as you can get. I find less and less does the actual music, like the genre or the sound matter to me as much as the sort of the feeling behind it and what the artist is trying to express. It's really allowed me to expand my musical taste over the years too. And also be open to whatever that artist that I love that did something totally different 20 years ago is doing now, you know, because the reason I loved them was probably the feeling, you know?
Right. Feel the feelings. Don't worry about the rules. There shouldn't be any.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, well, again, we really appreciate you coming on. It just is, you know, it's a real honor and a privilege to have you on the show. And I'm so glad your whole, your team was so great about making this happen. It, you know, I wouldn't have thought to ask, and I'm glad that they approached us because you were definitely on my list. Yeah. I have a long list of people I want to talk to on the show, and you're near the top of that. And here we are. So I just, you know, like I said, the stuff you've done it really had a huge impact on me from a very young age. And so I just really, really appreciate you coming on and taking the time to talk about what you're doing now, because it's
Kevin, you should mention important. That list is so funny because it's like, Kira was on the list, but also like Obama's on the list, right? Like it's a very,
hey, there's nothing wrong with dreams. There's nothing wrong with goals at all. And I'm honored to have been on that list because you were brainstorming but that's what we do, right? That's how we set a course and we don't get attached to the outcome. We just set the course.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for having me, you guys. It's been really good to do this.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening, everybody.